For a generation, Seattle's single-family neighborhoods have been changing. Back in the 90s, more lots became tall, slender, skinny houses, to the dismay of some of their neighbors who put up signs saying, "No skinny houses." In the past decade, upzoning to accommodate new residents has meant more townhouses, those fourplexes on lots where there used to be a single home. And more recently, we're seeing the phenomenon of the big house on the small lot, sometimes towering over their neighbors. Accelerating the trend is a loophole that developers discovered. They would call it an opportunity. It allows bigger houses on undersized lots that were established as separate building sites before 1957. Some of these new houses at popped up in what neighborhoods assumed was just a backyard. Some of them are three stories high, and some neighbors are pretty mad about it. Aaron Miller is a resident of the Montlake neighborhood and one of the original members of One Home Per Lot, a multi-neighborhood group that's trying to put an end to these backyard houses. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your experience. I understand you watched one of these houses go up in your own neighborhood. What was that like?
Yes, we live across the street from a house that was sold, and shortly after it was sold, we noticed a property market going up. We inquired and learned that a three-story house was planned for the former backyard of the original home. Other than the little markers, the little property markers, there was no notice to neighbors. None of those proposed land use action white signs you're used to seeing around the city, and we realized we were really lucky to have discovered what was happening.
And three stories a lot higher than the other houses around it. What kind of an impact has it had?
We were fortunate in that we got involved a little bit earlier, and we were able to work with the city and keep it to the what codes these exceptions do have for this house. So it is taller than the other home. I think one of our biggest concern is how close it is to the neighboring house, and that the way these houses are built, this business model is built upon taking value from the neighboring houses around it. To have value.
Taking value from the other houses? What do you mean by that?
It's so close and doesn't follow the typical setbacks as required by our zoning in our area. So it's allowed to be closer to the other houses around it.
Okay.
And so when you go to resell your house and you now have something looking over you less than 5 feet away, it affects the resale value of your home.
Now, Aaron, currently the Department of Planning and Development here in Seattle is looking at some new regulations to limit these kinds of houses. Do you think they go far enough?
I think some of them are great, and we really appreciate them listening to us neighbors and giving us a chance to be heard. I think some of them, like the proposed 80% rule, is not as simple as the lobbyists are saying it is, and is very concerning to all the members.
Okay.
Of the Home Per Lot.
And we're going to explain what that 80% rule is in just a few moments. Aaron Miller, thank you so much for joining us, a homeowner in Montlake, member of One Home Per Lot, sharing her story. Maybe you've gotten experience with one of these backyard or small lot developments. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. What do you think the city should do about them, if anything? It's 800-289-5869. Are these developments necessary for the growth our city is experiencing? You can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Next, we're going to hear from people involved in growth management who don't always see eye to eye. In fact, they've had a spirited back and forth on the internet about this issue. Roger Valdez is director of Smart Growth Seattle. It's a group that encourages small lot development. Roger is an urbanism and planning blogger. He has read the entire Seattle land use code, and we'll be doing a pop quiz later in the interview to make sure, check on some of those for you. Mark Hinshaw is an urban designer and contributor to Crosscut. He also writes about urbanism and planning. And in a recent article, Mark wrote that the developers in this case are abusing well-intended land use laws and being greedy by building these houses. Mark, how do you think these developers are abusing these laws?
Well, I want to step back for a minute and say that I certainly see the merit of having infill development within neighborhoods, but it needs to be done in a way that is respectful of the pattern of development and the scale of development.
And what does infill development mean?
It's making use of smaller lots that have been overlooked, that have not been built on for any number of reasons, whether topography or access or other factors, and to put forms of development in there that allow for a wider array of choices.
So you're in line with the general idea behind this, but...
But it's also necessary to have, because there is an existing context, existing neighborhood, it's necessary to have good, solid, clear, understandable standards so that addition is a gentle one, relatively gentle one, rather than a sudden and jarring one.
What does that mean, a gentle one?
It would be smaller scale buildings, lower height buildings, structures that are generally reflecting the predominant pattern of development in that neighborhood, so that the end result is not something you could easily point to. You might not even notice it at first in the ideal result.
Roger Valdez, what do you think? Should we allow these neighborhoods to have this infill, to have more buildings there, but make them gentler, smaller, lower?
Well, first of all, housing is a lot like people. It comes in all shapes, sizes, colors, and diversity and variety is a good thing. These aren't big houses on small lots. They're smaller houses on smaller lots. And I kind of thought we were going to have a debate here, but Mark and I agree. Our proposal of the 80% rule creates height limits.
Let me stop you right there, because we've mentioned the 80% rule a couple of times, but we haven't really explained what it is. What is the 80% rule?
That would allow small lot development on lots that were 80% of the average block of the average size lot on a block, which is predictable because everybody can kind of figure out what 80% of the average size lot is. There are height limits, so we our agreement there, 22 feet height, which is two stories. Setbacks or yards is what they really are. And these houses would be appropriately scaled because they couldn't be on lots that were sort of disproportionately smaller than the average lot.
And you're saying these are the right rules to have?
These are the right rules because they create predictability for the neighbors who can look and say, well, I know which lot might get developed, and for builders existing neighbors, people that are there already.
Well, here's where you might disagree. Mark, do you think that goes far enough, or do we need to do more than the 80% rule when it comes to providing for gentle development in
these
neighborhoods?
Well, I think we probably, if we disagree anywhere, it's probably on the detail and the extent of
That's the where the devil is, as I understand
yes,
it.
Yes, the devil's
like,
in the detail.
Give me an example of where.
Well, I think for a number of years I lived in a houseboat on the east side of Lake Union, and there's a really restrictive, as many people know, really restrictive height limit on houseboat heights, building heights. And it is around 18 feet. And yet, people have done amazing ranges of styles and forms and accommodations for living, and still within that very, very seemingly restrictive height limit. And I think it may take something like that to ensure to the neighbors that this is indeed a soft addition, not a sudden break in that pattern. So I guess it's just a matter of, you know, in some cases a matter of degree rather than intent.
Do you think it is just a matter of degree, Roger, when it comes to this?
Well, if you go to our website, smartgrowthseattle.org, you'll see some renderings there that show that, you know, the homes that we build are very much in scale. They're smaller. They take up less space, they're not as tall, and they fit in. You know, single-family 5,000 zoning allows a pretty substantial size house. And so when you go and look at those images, what you'll see is smaller homes amidst other sized homes. So I think the 22 feet's important because it allows two stories, not three. And that's that. There are some examples of three stories out there, but we're talking two-story houses.
Curtis Baker wrote on Facebook about this. We were asking for comments. He wrote, "What used to be a garden potential home quickly becomes blocked of light. Looks like it has zero curb appeal and no place to plant. You all can have your density while I pay half my green space oasis to the burbs." So Curtis seems to be saying that this affects me if it's going to be casting a shadow on my backyard. Is that a legitimate concern, Roger? And do you think that these rules go far enough to make sure that Curtis has his green space oasis in the backyard?
Well, change isn't easy. And if we're going to grow and create housing variety and choice and opportunity for new people coming into the region and into the city, we want them to live here in Seattle. And single-family homes are one of the options. And occasionally, that's going to create a change in the neighborhood. Certainly, if people want to maintain views and all those things, that's important. But we also have to consider the broader impact on carbon emissions and the economics of the region.
So too bad for his backyard?
I'd have to see his backyard. I don't know. I've never been there.
What about that concern? I mean, what we're really talking about is when does your development impinge upon someone else, and can you measure it in square footage? Can you measure it on a shadow cast upon your lawn? Can we get to that in the details, Mark, or is someone always going to object to that building next door for some reason or another?
Well, certainly people can object to lots of different things, but what's a legitimate objection, I think, is the question. But one of the cities that's been seeing a lot of infill into single-family neighborhoods over the last couple of decades is Vancouver, B.C. And they encourage it in a pretty broad way. But they make sure that as those buildings come in, they even look at where the windows are. So they're not overlooking into somebody else's bedroom or backyard. They're very sort of almost surgical in their insertions of these developments into an existing place to make sure that it doesn't disturb the current residents.
So beyond just a height number, they will actually imagine where that window will be and what that window will see.
Or put limitations on it or require planting or something that doesn't permit that intrusiveness mm-hmm. that people are finding objectionable.
When it comes to like that level of detail, do you think that's what we should be doing, Roger?
Well, you know, think about your bus ride into work today and think about the people that were on the bus ride and that were sitting there. They're not all height, weight proportionate. They're not all the same size. They don't all wear the same clothes. Housing is similar. Certainly there needs to be some limits, but we need variety in different types of housing. And that's driven by what people want to live in and what they want to buy. And I think just like the person that wrote in wanted to have their backyard and their garden, people want to have windows where they want to have windows. And so we believe that they should have those opportunities to build those things, just like people can dress the way they want to dress when they get on the bus.
Well, I got to say, I have some empathy for Curtis because when he bought that house, he probably bought it in part for that backyard. And in some ways, it kind of changes the rules. He made a decision based on how that house looked. Is that to say that if you are buying a home and expect it to not have a shade going over the backyard and expect it not to have a house next door that's going to look directly into your backyard, your expectations are too high?
No, I mean, I think predictability is a word that we're all using. And I think that our proposal creates that predictability. So if I buy a home in a single family neighborhood, I can look at the relative lot size of my lot and the lots around it and know, hey, nobody's going to be able to build next to me because those are smaller than the minimum 2,000 floor that's been established and what we're proposing.
Well, do you agree with that, Mark? Do we have predictability? And another way to put it is that sometimes looking at these codes or make it difficult for the average person to understand what they mean and what the implications might be for their lot. Do we have predictability, A? And B, is the average person buying a house able to figure it out?
Well, that's actually a really good question. My view of codes is they should be very, very simple so that just a normal person can figure it out without going to an architect, an engineer, or an attorney. And so when you start piling on very complex standards that involve formulas and percentages and overlays and multitude of things, it's really tough for people to have that predictability.
But Mark,
interesting they could be surprised.
Because you're saying that, you know, in your Crosscock article, you wanted to impose FAR and you also want to—
I'm sorry, FAR.
Floor area ratio. And that's a very complicated thing for people to understand. And, you know, our proposal is pretty straightforward. It's height, 22 feet, two stories, and that's it. So we think it's pretty straightforward.
You think it's simple enough to understand so someone buying a home could look at it and know this is what it means for my garden, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, people know what two stories looks like. They can measure 22 feet and they can understand what that would look like next to their own home.
Mark Roger says your proposal is more complicated. You'd make it harder to figure out.
Actually, floor area ratio is something you own the back of an envelope, so it's not really that complex. It's just a simple multiplication that most people could do. But that would be another discussion. I guess I would, if you're looking for a little disagreement here, that I would dispute whether or not it is appropriate to compare with people with houses, and that when you're on a bus, you're not there for very long. You can choose to move off. It's your choice. You might even not want that person there, and you'd leave the bus or move down the row. But with a house, that's a long-term family investment, household investment. And once you're there for a reasonably long term, and you want that predictability that somebody can't come in and sort of detract from what you have put in place potentially over decades of time.
Okay, we have a difference in metaphors here, at the very least, if not more than that. Roger, in your recent article on The Stranger's Slog, it was titled, Seattle Needs to Welcome Growth and Get Over Itself. And in it you say, stop fiddling with the details. What do you mean with that? About that? Are we just too preoccupied with this?
Yeah, this is really about people, not buildings and plans and design. It really is about opening our arms wide and embracing all the new people that are moving into our city And they all need a place to live. And some of them are going to live in smaller single-family homes that are designed by the people I work with. And some of them are going to live in tiny apartments, and some of them are going to live in bigger apartments. But when we sit and quibble about the way everything's going to look all the time, we're making it harder for those people to come. And really, we need to embrace them, just like the people on the bus.
Mark, are we like covering up our Statue of Liberty here and not welcoming people to Seattle by putting these rules into place?
Well, I think as long as the rules are simple and understandable and can be grasped within a few minutes of time and not require, as I said, another professional to figure it out.
Two stories and yards and no smaller lot than 2,000 square feet. That's it.
Let's bring another voice into this. Derek Williams owns one of the homes that we're talking about, and he recently got some negative attention in a neighborhood forum. We asked him how that feels.
You know, at first, to be honest, I laughed. But then, you know, the rhetoric started cranking up. People not even in our neighborhood were chiming in on both sides. You know, I started feeling hot on the neck, you know. And I live here. It's my neighborhood, too.
Mark, does this discussion have the potential to get uncivil? I mean, we like to think of ourselves as fairly civil here in Seattle. Is it getting a bit too heated? What do you think?
Well, I think we have always put a great deal of stock in the quality and character of our neighborhoods. And so, I mean, that's one of our traditions, is we value those places highly. And they are unique. They are unusual. And so we tend to engage in a lot of discussions over it. A lot of discourse. It's been going on for many decades. And so I don't see that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think we just collectively we can work through these issues and make a result that's reasonable.
Roger, Mark says it's not quibbling. It's kind of the very basis of our lives here. We do
Mark,
care about our neighborhoods.
You characterize people like Derek as a double income earning couple with a penchant for conspicuous consumption. That's unfriendly. That's not welcoming. That's not consistent with our values in the Northwest and the city of Seattle. I think Derek and people with double incomes that want to buy these homes, we should welcome them. Every ugly house is a house that, as you said, somebody spent a lot of money to, you know, their wealth and their hope and future to get in that house. And that means a lot to them. And so you have organizations like One House, One Lot that are putting up pictures of people's homes and saying these are awful houses. That's not consistent with our values. We need to change that and be more welcoming and recognize the difference is a good thing.
Mark, well, you want to respond to that?
I don't think it's a good idea for anybody to point fingers at individuals because tastes can vary
but
widely.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of unfair and mean-spirited. But I think generally speaking, we engage in a pretty robust civic debate about whenever change occurs in our community, and that's a good thing. And we generally work through it. And I think this is one of those issues where we can work through it and come up with a solution that is workable for most, if not all, people.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. David Neiman owns David Neiman Architects. And David, I understand you think there's something that has kind of been missing from this discussion which has been taking place. What is that? David, are you with us? Guess we lost him. In that case, let's go to Genevieve. She's listening to us in the Fremont neighborhood. Maybe you've got a reaction to some of these buildings that are houses that are being built in your neighborhood, and maybe you've been closely following the rules that we're discussing, the 80% rule, the FAR rule. We've talked about them a little bit earlier, and you've got some definite ideas on what we should or should not be doing, and maybe you think the metaphor that both of these gentlemen have are wrong. Let's go to Genevieve in Fremont. Genevieve, thanks for calling. What would you like to say about this?
Hi there. I actually am a former homeowner who sold because of the inability to figure out what my neighbors were going to do sometime in the future with lots both to the east and to the south of me, where they could divide up currently disallowed structures, bulldoze them, and build 5 to 7 houses. I would lose all my privacy and light from the south. In any case, I think in the bigger picture, that's just me. I sold. I couldn't stand not knowing.
But you knew from looking at it this could happen.
Being an architect who's not allowed to call herself an architect because I don't have a license, but I have a degree in practice building
yeah.
houses, I'm very familiar. And I was 30, and I bought a house for $125,000 in Wallingford. And that's not something you can do every day. You can't move that. I think that Seattle's in big trouble if they decide that something called single-family zoning is not single family. I think the whole city suffers in terms of the value of the city. I think natural habitat and quiet suffers. I also think it's a joke to think that you can put more people in a little cottage than in appropriate townhouses or larger apartment buildings built along arterials.
Genevieve, thanks a lot for your phone call. I do have another call. I want to get back into the conversation. You can also write to us, by the way, conversation@kuow.org. David Neiman is back. He owns David Neiman Architects, and you wanted to bring something to this conversation we have not perhaps heard before, David. What is that?
Oh, hi, Ross. Thanks for having me. You know, instead of arguing about the least awful way to shoehorn more houses into slivers in the middle of the block, we've proposed a better alternative that's not a zero-sum alternative. And essentially, here's the question that no one's asking. Can we accommodate new people coming into single-family neighborhoods while actually improving the fabric of the neighborhood? We believe the answer is yes, and we believe that the way to do it is sitting right in front of us, which is to allow two houses on every corner lot, not just one.
Allow two houses, and that will solve the issue. You'll get more density. You won't harm the neighborhood, you would say.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's I want to hear what my guests have to say to that. That's a third proposition here. What would you like to say to that, Mark?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing to perhaps talk about. I'm not sure how it's directly related to the issue that's before the city council, but I think
it might not be. But it's another way to increase density, perhaps without harm.
I would say that there's probably a dozen different ways that we could contemplate, and that's what we need to do is maybe have even a broader debate of what are all the housing choices that we should be encouraging that we're not now, and how could we best do those so they don't disrupt an area.
And yet, you both talked about certainty. If you throw it open, I mean, doesn't that get more uncertainty for people who just don't know what their neighborhood's going to be like in 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I wasn't suggesting just throwing the door open to anything, but deciding where they should occur, how they could occur, you know, what are the appropriate locations, and whether they're geography or conditions or whatever. I think there's a good debate there.
I love David's idea. I mean, the corner lot is really crucial. It's been an opportunity that's been with us for a long time. I think it's a both-and thing for us. I mean, I think creating more opportunities on the corners because of the way they're configured could address this. But infill is important as well. And I think both of those things together are something good to look at.
David, quick question before we let you go. Why the corner? Why two buildings on the corner? Why would that not harm the neighborhood?
Well, when you put two houses on the corner, your typical Seattle block face has sort of narrow front ends facing the avenues, and then nothing's facing the street. And so when you turn the corner, what you're doing is you're allowing new homes actually face the side streets. It takes the qualities that we like about the long block faces, where you have front porch activities, porch sitting, gardening, social engagement with your neighbors, and now you're extending them around the corner. You're actually creating more of the kind of block face that people want, and you're doing it while creating opportunities for these kind of infill things that you could direct to a good place on the block, and that would allow you the opportunity to take the places that are creating all the conflict, which is infilling into these narrow side lots, and shut them down.
Hey, David, thank you so much for sharing that with us. David Neiman owns David Neiman Architects. And thanks also to Roger Valdez, Director of Smart Growth Seattle, and Mark Hinshaw, urban designer and contributor to Crosscut. We've learned about FAR. We've learned about the 80% rule. We've learned about metaphors for what to use and what not to use. Thanks so much for joining us. This is The Conversation on KUOW.